This is a Thinking Aloud podcast from the BBC, and for more details on our terms of use and much, much more about Thinking Aloud, go to our website at bbc.co.uk. Hello. Am I hallucinating, or do I really remember a day back in the early 60s when, together with several hundred other people, many of them dressed in the standard hippie uniform of the time, you know, loon pants, tie-dyed T-shirts and bedraggled Afghan goats, I stood in a queue which stretched all the way back down Denmark Hill in South London, simply in order to have a chance of participating in the Maudsley Hospital's trial of LSD. Now, I think, and I vaguely remember reading it, that the organisers panicked when they saw the alarming effects the drug was having on some of the recipients, because news quickly came back down the line that the trial had been suspended. Well, tragically indeed, no such action was taken, or could have been taken, in the notorious drug trial which took place in the building next to Northwick Hospital, North London, on the 13th of March, 2006. At 8 a.m. on that day, after a series of medical checks, six young men were, each in turn, injected with an experimental drug labelled TGN-1412. The setting up and the infusion of the drugs into their arms took around 10 minutes. So it was while the final man was being treated, just after 9 o'clock, that the first of the six volunteers given the drug complained of a headache. Thereafter, all six men fell very seriously ill, too critically, and were hospitalised for several weeks. Well, the media naturally called for someone to be held to account, but after much deliberation and inquiry, it was decided the fault was a systemic problem rather than the fault of an individual or group of individuals. In other words, it was a mistake rather than misconduct. But what was the nature of the mistake, the systemic problem? How did it come about? How might it have been avoided? Well, these are questions addressed in a new research paper by Professor Adam Hedgko, who's Associate Director of the Centre for Economic and Social Aspects of Genomics at Cardiff University. When I met him earlier, I began by asking him to remind me of what was discovered during the inquiry into the tragedy.
There were a number of irregularities with the trial that were highlighted, firstly by the MHRA, which is the drugs regulator in the UK, which performed a very quick inquiry, and then by the expert scientific group that was convened by the Secretary of State for Health, which took a six-month period and took a lot of evidence. The conclusion was that this was just one of those things, that drugs trials, one of the things that these kinds of drugs trials, phase one drugs trials do, is to discover whether drugs are safe. And in this case, unfortunately, the trial did what it was supposed to do and discovered that this drug isn't safe. So in that sense, the formal inquiries avoided finding anyone or anything to blame for the running of the trial.
Now, this is where you come into the picture, because at the time you are studying research ethics committees, aren't you?
Yeah.
Just tell me quickly what a research ethics committee is.
Well, research ethics committees approve research carried out in the NHS before it takes place. So before a drugs trial or an epidemiological study or even a psychological study on, say, patients takes place, it goes to a research ethics committee who assess the safety, what the possible benefits might be, what the possible risks to participants, decides whether the information given to participants allows them to make a free and fair decision whether to take part in it or not.
So you're studying these committees, and now you turn your attention specifically to the Research Ethics Committee which approved this trial. That's right, isn't it?
Yes.
So, and you interviewed members of that committee, you used the Freedom of Information Act to obtain details of the meeting at which the decision was made?
Yes.
And your conclusion, when you started to look at this, I mean, you started to look at how it had come about, but perhaps we can concentrate on what it was that you would want to say seemed to you to have gone wrong in this particular case, although, as you want to point out, pretty well standard practice was being followed in many respects.
In the aftermath of the trial, the key point that a number of commentators raised issues about was the idea that you dosed all the healthy volunteers with the drug at relatively short intervals, almost at 10-minute intervals, rather than, say, dosing one person and waiting for a couple of hours to see whether there was a reaction. And a number of commentators suggested that it was irresponsible and bad practice for the company running the trial to dose people like this, and that the Research Ethics Committee should never have approved the trial on this basis. But what became very clear quite quickly, partly because the MHRA admitted that 80% of phase one trials use this short interval dosing scheme, but also through my interviews with people on the Ethics Committee and people who run these trials, this was absolutely standard. It was very normal to dose people at relatively short intervals.
But this is when we're beginning to use the word normalised, isn't it? We were saying that over a period of time, this idea of short interval dosing somehow becomes accepted. I mean, how does it become accepted? Because anybody listening to this at the moment would say, well, quite clearly, if you're testing out a new drug, it'd be a very good idea to try it on somebody and wait a couple of hours to see what the effect was.
Yes, it's very interesting. I went back over the, if you like, the regulations produced by the pharmaceutical industry from the 1970s onwards. And certainly around 1970, these regulations were produced by something called the Stewart-Harris Committee, were quite clear that you should dose an individual at the start of a trial rather than a number of people. And this requirement carried through to about, as far as I can tell, sometime in the 1980s. And at that point, around 1988, the industry guidelines stopped talking about the need to dose an individual. And what seems to have happened is over time, this requirement has just disappeared, certainly in terms of the written guidance, and has become part of the accepted standard practice, which isn't clearly spelled out.
Now, you don't want to say that this is due to pressure from drug companies to push results through quickly. You don't want to say that there's anybody on the committee who's, if you like, misbehaving or a deviant. You want to say that this is something which often emerges in systems like these ethics committees.
Yes.
Expand on that a little.
Yes, I mean, the ideas I used borrow from Diane Vaughan, who did work on the space shuttle challenge disaster. And she coined the term normalisation of deviance, which is a process whereby over a period of time, particular behaviours which in retrospect look irresponsible or look bad become normalised within particular social groups, become standard practice. And so she suggests a number of ways of thinking about this. And I think this is what happened in the community of people around phase one trials, that's both researchers and ethics committees. Because no phase one trial had gone wrong, because nothing had happened, there seemed no reason not to allow short interval dosing. Short interval dosing had happened before, no one had been harmed. There didn't seem a reason not to approve the next trial that involved short interval dosing.
You say that one of the things that lies behind this is the way the trust had developed between the ethics committee and the CRO, that the CRO referring to the contract research organisations. We need to explain that drug companies themselves aren't carrying out these trials. They, in fact, commission a CRO, a contract research organisation, to carry them out for them. They've been doing it for years and years. There have been lots and lots of cases. And you say, over a period of time, trust develops between these two.
Exactly.
But by and large, you would regard the TGN-1412 trial as very unusual, and it doesn't suggest to you that drug trials are, by and large, badly organised or that ethics committees are not behaving appropriately.
No, I think in terms of the literature around research ethics committees and pharmaceutical regulation, there's an acceptance that, I would say that these organisations are what are called high reliability organisations. This is a system which works, by and large, very safely and has a number of checks and balances. But even within a high-reliability organisation, there are problems and there are faults. And I think the TGN-1412 exposes some of these and the way in which particular behaviours become normalised.
Yes, you have a beautiful quote by a man from Harvard, I think it's Harvard Business School, is it, called Scott Snookin. I was thinking of actually putting this quote, having it embroidered and put on the wall of my flat to look at every day. It says, "Each uneventful day that passes reinforces a steadily growing false sense that everything is all right." Now, that seems to me a perfect statement of the way in which a terrible mistake suddenly occurs within an organisation that previously seemed to have been running perfectly well.
Yes. Scott Snoot's work, which is around military decision-making, I think, is a very good example of this process, whereby within a system that seems to be working perfectly well, sudden events happen, and although no one has done anything differently, and no one has done anything differently from the way in which they were doing things on previous occasions, that process in itself is flawed at a certain level and produces disastrous outcomes.
Professor Adam Hedgecoe, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I still like that quotation. I'm just going to read it again, because it just seems to capture so many of these circumstances in which tragic events occur, but it's not possible to allocate blame. Here goes. It's each uneventful day that passes reinforces a steadily growing false sense of confidence that everything is all right, that my group must be okay because the way we did things today resulted in no adverse consequences. Yeah, very powerful sense, but a bit too long to scrawl on a wall, so it can't even be a contender in our quest, which you may remember was prompted by Paul Hambley for intelligent graffiti. Of course, as one listener reminded me, the very best examples date back to the 1960s and the Situationists, who produced such gems as Under the Paving Stones, The Beach, or Do Not Adjust Your Set, There's a Fault in Reality. And this one, I think that this was coined by Raoul Van Egem. Those who talk about revolution and class struggle without referring to everyday reality have a corpse in their mouth. Well, Bill Major, as I'm sure he'd acknowledge, can't quite reach such, well, apocalyptic heights, but I did enjoy his emailed memory of this graffito reference to a man who at the time was his politics tutor at Liverpool University. It was scrawled on the wall of the university gents' toilet and read, "Robert Kilroy Silk is a careerist." The wall got it right. I can't say the same for all those who responded to last week's discussion on the treatment of Slovakian au pairs. A couple of listeners, you see, found the discussion quite one-sided because they knew from personal experience of French or German au pairs who'd been treated very, very well by their English hosts. But the point of the research was to show how this all altered when the au pair's country of origin, Slovakia, allowed them to be regarded not as cultural equals, but at least in some cases as peasants. Otherwise, it was rather a good week for backhanded compliments. Here's Jerry Griffin. "Hi, Laurie. Big fan. Take this the right way, but I found popping your podcast under the pillow is a sure fine way of knocking me out. A powerful combination of the quiet tones and those abstract nouns. Keep well." And then this, a postscript to an interesting letter about au pairs and living conditions from Michael Martin. "Laurie, I feel on leaving your seminar like the ever-smiling student who told me at the door, 'Every time I leave your class, I feel I know less than when I came in,' correcting herself when she saw my expression with an enthusiastic, 'No, I mean I realise there's even more to learn than I did before.'" In case you'd like to comment on anything in today's programme, here are our addresses. Thinking Aloud, BBC Radio 4, Broadcasting House, London, W1A, 1AA, or you can email us at thinkingaloud@bbc.co.uk. And of course, if you'd like to hear the programme again, consult our extensive archive, sign up for my newsletter this week, My Shameful Secret, or seek out a pillow-popping podcast. All you have to do is go to this website and click through bbc.co.uk/radio4. Laura, what a beautiful tune, but I play it now for political rather than aesthetic reasons, because its composer, David Raxin, was one of the victims of the McCarthy era in the United States. After being forced by the House Un-American Activities Committee to admit to his former membership of the Communist Party, he joined the long list of Hollywood artists who were blacklisted for years. Also on that blacklist was Walter Bernstein, screenwriter and film producer, who later described the effect upon his career.
"I came in one day and the producer said, I can't use you anymore. I've been told from my boss upstairs." There was an air of fear in the country, particularly if you were liberal. People avoided you. The people whom I knew would see me coming across the street so as not to be seen with me. The FBI paid monthly visits. They were kind of telling you they knew where you were. You know, it was a fearful, you know, lousy time.
That was Walter Bernstein on the recent Radio 4 programme. There were reds under the bed, in which David Aronovich revealed that many of McCarthy's fears about Soviet infiltration were well-founded. Well, these memories of McCarthy are prompted now by a new paper published in the American Sociological Review with the title Stained Red, A Study of Stigma by Association to Blacklisted Artists During the Red Scare in Hollywood, 1945 to 1960. Its co-author is Elizabeth Pontiques, and she wrote the paper along with Giacomo Negro and Hayagriva Rao. And Elizabeth is Assistant Professor of Organisations and Strategy at the University of Chicago Booth School of Business, and she now joins me online from Chicago. And here in the studio, I'm kept company by Adam Cooper, Visiting Professor of Anthropology at LSE. Elizabeth, you begin your paper by talking about the moral panic which existed in Hollywood in the 1940s and 50s, which began with the identification by HUAC of a relatively small number of communists. Perhaps you better tell me what you mean here by moral panic.
Sure. Well, a moral panic arises when suddenly there's a heightened level of concern over a certain kind of behavior or category of people. And usually the level of concern is disproportionate to any careful analysis of any threat that would actually be posed by that group. Famous examples are the executions of people who are identified as witches in Renaissance Europe and in Salem, Massachusetts, or Prohibition in America, or the mods and rockers, the violence and the arrests that were associated with them in the 1960s in London. And basically what happens is this group is identified as like folk devils, and they're stereotyped as representing everything that's evil and immoral in society, and they're seen against what is generally an overly typical background.
So disproportionality is a key thing here. Adam, do you find this use of the term moral panic useful in this context?
Well, I'm a great fan of the idea of moral panic that Stan Cohen has given such depth and currency to. I'm not entirely sure that it's applicable here or how strongly it's applicable here, because after all, when you're dealing with the Hollywood left, who are the targets of this strategy of repression, you're dealing with people, many of whom were indeed left-wing at a time when the Cold War was just beginning to take root in the United States. And the Screenwriters Guild had been a genuinely left-wing organization right from the 1930s. So, and they'd been watched carefully by Washington long before McCarthy from the 1930s. When the Hayes Office was set up, it didn't only police morals, it also policed politics. So we're dealing here with a real political situation, and no doubt, obviously, there was a great deal of exaggeration and a great deal of hysteria, and I think there are good reasons for that. But call it a moral panic, to put it on a level with persecution of witches is, I think, a stretch.
Do you want to come back on that, Elizabeth?
Yeah, I would. So what happens at the time when this panic erupts, the Communist Party is actually on decline in the United States, and it never really posed any real threat to the United States government in terms of numbers or in terms of its organization. It was actually very hard to organize. In addition, the people who were targeted were part of Hollywood, not really part of the military part of the government, although, of course, that was a side arm of the McCarthy era that began to erupt really as the communist threat was starting to decline, or as the moral panic was starting to decline. And if you compare this to the persecution of witches in Renaissance Europe, for us it may seem very ridiculous that anyone might be seen as a witch. But at the time when you have this Christian, the church being very integrated with the government, and people not, the scientific revolution hadn't happened, that was actually seen as just as much of a threat to the people back then as communism would be seen in the 1950s in the United States.
Now, I want to move on from that to the other idea which you introduced, because of your actual research, what it's looking at is the way in which this Red Scare in Hollywood and the degree to which it was a moral panic, a matter of disagreement, but the way in which this Red Scare damaged the careers of a great many more people than the 300 individuals who were originally targeted by the House of Un-American Activities. You use here, the second concept in your paper, is the idea of courtesy stigma, derived from Irving Goffman, I think. Tell me what this means.
Well, so Goffman wrote seminal work on stigma in the 1960s, and he introduces this concept of courtesy stigma, which is basically that people can acquire stigma the way you might acquire a disease. So people who have an alcoholic father or a disabled spouse may be seen as less capable, less intelligent. So there's inferences made just by the fact that you have an association with someone who is stigmatized. And this is part of what my co-authors Jacques Monegro, Hayagriva, and I thought was interesting about what could happen during the Red Scare. So what stigma can do is not just affect the people who are stigmatized, but it also can spread in a very insidious way to other, you may think of as innocents in the population.
So, I mean, to blacklist, if you had been blacklisted, even if people who were exposed for a single time to blacklisted people, this had an effect upon their employment in future.
Yeah, and what we study here is stigma by what we call mere association. So not a relationship that you enter into voluntarily or knowingly, but we look at whether or not you were associated with someone before they became blacklisted. And this we see as a very thin social connection that that in any careful analysis, you wouldn't really attribute stigma to this other party.
I mean, we're talking about such things as just simply being in the same film as another person who was blacklisted, aren't we?
Exactly. So the way we measure this is, were you in a film with someone who was blacklisted later on? So it's not that the person was blacklisted before you were in a film with them. You would have no idea that this person was about to be blacklisted. But then once they are blacklisted, you have a lower odds of finding work in Hollywood at that time.
Let me turn to you, Adam. Do you find this this persuasive, the idea, this stigma by association playing a significant part in causing people to lose their livelihoods in the American film industry?
It's an interesting idea. I'm sure there is something in this. The argument's very well documented here. But I think there's something else happening which I would expect to be perhaps as important or more important. If you switch the perspective and you ask who is organizing this hunt for Reds and what do they have to gain? And it's being organized by a right-wing group in Congress and various religious leaders. And as it works, as it gets traction in the country, the people who are running it get rewards for this. They get funds, they get political support. They want it to go on. And the only way they can go on is they find more and more people involved. And obviously, and the fact that they're looking at Hollywood means there's a glamour attached to it, there's an excitement, people are interested, which probably wouldn't have been if they had been after the trade unions, for example. So there's that element in it. There's another element, which is that the Screenwriters Guild and the Screen Actors Guild, to a lesser extent, are at the time at daggers drawn with the owners of the studios. They're trying to get better contracts, they're trying to get more respect, they're trying to get more autonomy. And this gives the studio owners a very good excuse for cutting down the influence of the Screen Actors Guild, the Screenwriters Guild, which are associated with the left, and also with keeping actors, directors, and writers insecure, which strengthens their hold. So I think there are a lot of interests that are neglected in this argument. So if there are interests involved, more and more people have to be named. How do you find those people? Well, it's a little bit random, but you find friends of friends.
Elizabeth?
Well, what Adam's saying is exactly right. There's all sorts of dynamics going on in the Hollywood film industry in this time period. And what he's talking about, I do believe, happens. But what we are studying here is we're looking at stigma by mere association, and the way we do it is by isolating this factor in a statistical study. So what we take is all 30,000 people who were in the film industry in this time period. And we look at people who do not who are not named on the list. So they're political innocents. And then we look at what happens to them after one of their associates becomes blacklisted. Now, what we find is if you are in a film with someone who later becomes blacklisted, you're not more likely to become blacklisted. So it's not that we're finding people who are going to be named in the future and therefore being discriminated against. We actually find that there's a statistical effect that they're less likely to be named in the future. So it's not that we're finding that stigma by mere association identifies people who are going to be blacklisted later on. What we're finding is that when you're associated with this person, you're less likely to find work even though you don't have any communist affiliations. Another way we control for this is we look for the effect on people who starred in anti-communist films. And so these people, you might think, are absolutely on the other end of the spectrum. And we find the same effect for this group. So even if you've been in an anti-communist film, if you are linked in this mere association way to someone who's later blacklisted, you are still less likely to find work. We've done is we've tried to isolate this effect of mere association.
Let me just, Adam, you're an anthropologist. I mean, this idea of courtesy stigma, is this something with which you are familiar with in your own field work, perhaps, or in other people's field work?
No, it's not present in the anthropological literature, so far as I know. It might be something worth following up. What anthropology tends to show is, I suppose, a rather obvious point, which is that every society has its own system of stigma. So that in the Indian case, for example, stigma is associated with low caste positions. In ex-slave societies in the New World, it's
but presumably, if you associate with someone from a lower caste, this is an example, isn't it, of courtesy stigma?
Well, I don't know if it's courtesy stigma, yes. I mean, there is a pollution anxiety. And pollution is of course something which is very real in these societies. Is that stigma by association, perhaps?
Okay. Elizabeth, you do seem to suggest that this stigma by association can easily get out of control of the enforcers, those who set the process in motion in the first place. Is this, do you think, why the Red Scare came to an abrupt end in the late 50s? There were simply so many people indicted as a result of courtesy stigma that it was no longer possible to handle the numbers.
Well, we do think that this is one factor of why these kinds of panics can erupt and end very quickly. Now, of course, this isn't directly studied in our research, but you can imagine that once the stigma becomes so broad and so many people are affected by the taint, so my neighbor, who I know well, is also under suspicion, that people start to think a little more and their deliberate processes, so things you think through, might overtake your automatic process or these automatic associations you have. And then once the wall starts to crumble, then all of a sudden people start actively questioning this kind of stigma. So I do think it's possible that that's part of the what led to the decline.
Adam, would you have an alternative suggestion as to why McCarthyism folded up?
Well, I mean, the classic answer is that when McCarthy took on the army and started trying to find Reds in the army, he lost out the generals, and in fact Eisenhower turned against him. And that was the end. Instead of being the arch-patriot, he became seen as anti-patriotic. He lost out, and the whole movement collapsed at that stage. If he had stuck to Hollywood, I think he might have had a longer run.
Finally, Elizabeth, what do you think are the most significant implications of your research?
Well, the implications, we think, are that stigma really has powerful ways of transmitting across social divides and across social connections in an automatic and insidious way, so that people can be affected by stigma even if they do everything possible to try to avoid such a stigma.
And that
can affect individual people.
Okay, there I will have to stop you. Thank you very much, Elizabeth Pontikis and Adam Cooper. Last word today to playwright Lillian Hellman, who gave this response to Huac's request for the names of her former communist acquaintances as the price for her own exclusion from the list. She said, "To her, innocent people whom I knew many years ago in order to save myself is to me inhuman and indecent and dishonourable. I cannot and will not cut my conscience to fit this year's fashion." Well, I do hope you enjoyed that programme. And if you'd like to hear something similar, why not try downloading the In Our Time podcast at bbc.co.uk/radio4.